You're with John Cleary on Good Friday Night.
Thank you for joining us on this special Good Friday Night on ABC Radio. In a few moments, I'll be joined by a panel to discuss Richard Dawkins' recent challenge to Christianity that the idea of a tortured God at the heart of the faith is a twisted and depraved notion. But perhaps we can begin with the most appropriate music for the day, a selection from Bach's great cantata, the St. Matthew Passion. You're on ABC Radio this Good Friday evening. Well, the depth of sorrow and compassion revealed in such works as Bach's Great Chorale illustrate the continuing power of the imagery of selfless sacrifice for the love of others. This is the central symbol of Christianity, not a triumphant king, but a crucified peasant. As Christianity has moved across the globe over the past 2,000 years, the cross, not the crown, has been its most resonant image. Yet just a few weeks ago, on the ABC's Q&A program, scientist Richard Dawkins put a counterview. The New Testament, if you believe in the New Testament, that God, the all-powerful creator of the universe, couldn't think of a better way to forgive humanity's sins than to have himself put on earth, tortured and executed for the sins of humanity. What kind of a horrible, depraved notion is that? Here is a continuing mystery. How can Christianity at once claim to be about loving kindness and goodness when its central symbol is an image of evil, that is, the execution of an innocent person? What sort of God can allow this sort of evil? Well, for many, this is the central conundrum of faith, the image of innocent suffering seen in the faces of children born deformed or horribly maimed by acts of nature, such as earthquake or tsunami. They cannot be reconciled with any sort of loving God. Well, to discuss the continuing problem of evil, we are joined this Good Friday night by an old friend and former head of religious programs here at the ABC, the Reverend Dr. David Milliken. David, welcome.
Good day, John.
In our Canberra studios, Heather Thompson, Senior Lecturer in Theology at St. Mark's Theological College. Heather, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And also here in Sydney, the recently installed Catholic Bishop of Parramatta and the person responsible for World Youth Day in 2008, Bishop Anthony Fisher. Bishop, welcome.
Good evening, John.
And congratulations on your new position, the youngest Catholic bishop in the country, I understand.
Yes, yes. Very exciting.
I'm sure you'll get over that fairly quickly.
I'll age quick.
Bishop, Good Friday is the central event of the Christian year. What's its power, both theologically and perhaps more particularly emotionally?
Well, I think one thing it's not is a celebration of violence. And if that's what Dawkins or others think when they look at Christians today and see us gathering for prayer before a cross, then we've not explained ourselves very well. And I hope that most Christians celebrating today are not in any sense celebrating violence or a violent execution, as he suggested. We do know there is a lot of violence in our world. There's a lot of unloving. There's a lot of rivalry and ingratitude. And in a world where that was so much part of the human story, that God would choose to enter that world as a vulnerable human being himself and put himself into our hands is a story of love, of total love, his total giving of himself to us to the end. And that love cost. It cost him, and it shows that it can cost us, but it also achieved an extraordinary thing for us.
So it has very strong metaphorical power, if nothing else.
It tells that story of that love, of that total gift that was Good Friday, that is also Easter, that is also Christmas, the whole Christian story. And I think that tells us about total loving and its cost and what it achieves. It tells us that God really does identify with us in the depths of our suffering, that he's not just sublimely indifferent and at a great distance from our suffering. And it tells us that there's hope beyond Good Friday, beyond this day, that there is Easter to come, that suffering isn't the end of the story.
David Millikan, one can see how through literature and art and music, and we've heard some of the great music just a moment ago, that image has been enormously powerful, yet at the heart of it is a philosophical and intellectual conundrum. I mean, technically it's called theodicy. How do you explain evil if God is good?
I guess it is the great philosophical difficulty for Christians, more so than other religions, actually. If you believe in a God that is all-powerful, a God that is all-loving, then the continuing presence of evil in the world presents a problem. If you believe in reincarnation, or if you have a dualistic view or a deist view of God, all that sort of disappears. But if you hold to this active belief that God created the world good, that God is still in control of the world, and that God is a good God, then why is there evil? And any evil at all is immediately a problem. And it says to you, either God is not good and somehow has condoned this, or God's not all-powerful and doesn't know what to do about it, or can't, is powerless in the face of it. So that is a problem which has continued with the church right from the beginning, and there's been a thousand different ways of dealing with it. So,
well, Heather,
so I guess that's what we'll be talking about. And it's a wonderful issue to talk about.
Heather Thompson, perhaps it's appropriate to bring you in here because you're somebody who has written and thought about it. Professionally, you have to deal with this in teaching and training people on theology. Just give us an idea of how long this argument has been grappled with in the Christian church. It's not as if Richard Dawkins discovered it yesterday.
No, the trouble is it's a form of thinking about God, and it's a genuine question, so we're wondering why there's evil in the world, and it's not so much an intellectual question but something that gets you in the gut and undoes you when you see something, when you're a witness to terrible violence or mistreatment in some way, and you think, even if God wasn't all powerful, but just a bit powerful, you know, couldn't something be done here? Or if I were God, I would have stopped this. And so there's several levels on which it works. And over the years, of course, there's been a lot of attempts to come to terms with it. But it depends on what God you start with as to what answer you get to. So if you start with this all powerful God that's a monarch, and behind that are kind of models of kings that we've known and that are totalitarian sort of rules, then of course you've got a real problem. And if that were God, I would be an atheist too. So when you ask atheists why they are atheists, it depends on what God they don't believe in. Whereas the Christian God, as has already been said, is a different kind of God, and you don't start with all powerful, all, you know, omnipotent, omniscient, and those things. They're constructions of God from Greek philosophy. Whereas if the Christian way of knowing God is Jesus, God is humble and God is compassionate love, but still powerful in the sense of a kind of power, not absolute power, you know, look at me, look what I can do, the vulnerable power that will raise Jesus from the dead. In other words, always create opportunities for life beyond death, and that's what Easter is about.
That's the central conundrum, is it not, Anthony Fisher, that you've got an image established in Christian theology, and you can see it in a thousand churches, of the omnipotent, omniscient God, and at the same time, the conundrum of the vulnerable, self-sacrificing Christ. At which image of God holds true? Which image of God? And in some ways, the church has said, well, both. Well, how can it be both?
But I think it has to be both for us. If God doesn't have a promise for us, if he can't actually do anything for us or offer us anything beyond the mess we might be in right now, then we're going to think, well, why would I bother with him? But at the same time, well, we want him to actually have a power to do something about this. That's what we look to God for. we also want him to know what we're suffering, to actually be here with us, so not at such a distance because of his power, his knowledge, his other perfections. And I think we do somehow have to hold both and hold them in tension, that this God that is the reason there is anything that is, that is the creator and the redeemer of the world, this same God is a fragile baby, is a young man dying on a cross, is there in the mess of it with us.
Let's use a practical example, and David Milliken, I'll throw the example at you. A baby born, loved by parents, but struck by an affliction before they reach an age where they are conscious for themselves and can take any responsibility for themselves. So here we have apparent innocent suffering. How can a good God allow that sort of innocent suffering and pain to go on, particularly if it's a kid born with, say, cancer or a brain tumour or whatever, where the kid has to just suffer for 5 or 6 years and die? We can know cases of that. We read about them 3 or 4 times a year in the newspapers. What sort of God allows that? There's no notion of guilt and responsibility for evil or accepting the bad things because we've done wrong somewhere. It's not a case of balancing the scales. Here is just suffering for no apparent point.
Look, this same question was put to Jesus by his disciples when they came across a man who was born blind. It's important he's born blind. And they asked Jesus this question. They said, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he is born blind? Now, that tells us two things. One, it tells us that the disciples believed that that calamity was the product of sin. It was somehow a punishment for sin. And secondly, it tells us that they believed in reincarnation, which has always been an option for Orthodox Jewry. So they believe, they're saying, well, if it was his, well, perhaps it was his parents, the sins of the fathers get passed on. But this guy, but they opened the possibility that it was him in a former life. Now, Jesus rejects both of those answers. And so that they don't become options for us. So we're back to our problem. The problem is to how we account for that, if God's sort of like in control. Now, I sniffed the possibility of an answer in what Heather was saying. I'm mostly interested to see if she's aware of the openness of God debate, because that has recently persuaded me. I see those notions of God as being omnipotent, all-powerful, all-knowing. Perhaps in order to preserve the freedom and the choice of human beings in this life to say no to God, perhaps God has done what Jesus did. Jesus said that he limited himself. So he took on a limitation to enter into the world as this act of love that the bishop has talked about. Now, perhaps God has done the same thing. When God creates the world, the cosmos, God puts himself at risk in order to preserve the full weight of human freedom. And so, in a sense, God chooses not to know the ultimate outcome of aspects of history. And the way I see it is this: it's like God is the great architect of the cosmos. God, it's like you're building a house, and this is the greatest of all houses, and you know this house, you have it in your head. But in order to build it, you've got to account for weather, trade unions, the DA at the council, all that sort of stuff. And along the way, it is changed. You don't know what those changes are, but still you are the ultimate creator of that. And I think, in a way, that gives us a way of dealing with this question. And it deals with what I think is the common experience of God that people have. If you're a pastor and you go to people in trouble, they pray to God as if God can change things. And unless that possibility exists, that God can actually shift the cosmos in some sort of way, then we're lost. We're in this sort of passive relationship to this sort of God that doesn't really live with us in this world.
Bishop Anthony Fisher, how do you confront innocent suffering?
How I confront it in a person in front of me is very different to how I think it through when I have the space to do that and the distance to do that, the leisure to do that. And so I might speak from that perspective first, but I think how we deal with a human being suffering before us, or even ourselves, is a different matter. David mentioned the freedom that God has given us, and I think that it is God's great trust and great gamble with us. And trust in the sense that God thinks enough of us to let us be free, gives us enough by way of intellect and heart and relationships and opportunities to really make something of our lives and make something together, and he trusts that we can with his help. But it's a great gamble, because we can do awful things to ourselves and to each other too. And if he's going to make us that much, that free and intelligent and able to choose, then he has to leave us free to do things. And that is behind a great deal of the evil in our world, is things we do to each other and do to ourselves, and which have all sorts of repercussions, ones we could foresee and many that we don't. But in addition to that, if we're going to be free to choose, we also need a world in which there's patterns, there's a rhythm, there's a logic to things. So you know that, you know, day will follow night and night will follow day, and that if I speed up to 200 kilometres an hour on the road, certain things are likely to follow. That an angel won't intervene at that moment and take my foot off the pedal, or God won't at every point stop anything that I might do that's not wise. And so that means freedom requires not only that we be left with agency, with the ability to choose for good or ill at any time, but also that we be in a world that has its own laws and patterns, which is not to say God then abandons the whole project and just looks on laughing or bored with the whole thing, but it is to say, I think, that for human beings to be all we could be and should be, we have to actually be capable of moral evil, and in a world that has natural evil, as well as having the freedom to be morally good and have all the good things that are there in the world.
Heather, this takes us into the realm of the structure, the nature of the universe itself. What Bishop Anthony is saying is that, if I can interpret, that the condition of human freedom requires that in the very fabric of the universe, the capacity for freedom to be exercised must be built in some way. So this, in a way, is an explanation of both personal evil and the apparent evil of the natural world that we see, whether it be earthquake or flood or whatever.
That's right. I'm not quite satisfied with Answers to Theodicy that just talk about human freedom and the freedom of God, because the scientists I read who write on this, on evolution and science and God, talk about the freedom that's built into the creation itself. And so in order for it to develop, it needs its own freedom to be itself. Cancer has developed and it's been given its own place in this world. And we human beings are just among the other animals and living creatures in a huge ecology which has to have freedom in order to be itself. And part of that is therefore the reason why, you know, cancer exists. It's not just human freedom to do and act. It's the freedom inbuilt in this world that we live in. And we are very tenuous in our life, fragile lives, as all living creatures are. The other thing I don't like about just talking about human freedom and the freedom of God in this is that it makes God look like God is standing back and watching it and I know, Bishop, you said that that's not the case. It's more than that. But there's something in this question that has to do with the freedom that's inbuilt in creation and God companioning with us even so. You see what I'm saying?
Yes, and that's the difficult conundrum. How the end do you reconcile, as you've all pointed out, the problem of a universe that must be in some ways self-sustaining in order for freedom to be exercised, and yet a God who, we do say, in some ways walks with us. I'd like to return to that question after we've had a short piece of music. You're on ABC Radio on Good Friday Night. John Cleary with you. Our guests in the studio this evening, the Reverend Dr. David Milliken in our Canberra studios, Dr. Heather Thompson, Senior Lecturer in Theology at St. Mark's Theological College, and also here in Sydney, the recently consecrated Bishop of Parramatta and the person responsible for World Youth Day, Bishop Anthony Fisher. We're discussing the problem of evil, particularly as it relates to Good Friday. The question was stated rather succinctly a couple of weeks ago on the ABC's Q&A program by the well-known advocate for atheism, Richard Dawkins. Here's a reminder.
You believe, if you believe in the New Testament, that God, the all-powerful creator of the universe, couldn't think of a better way to forgive humanity's sins than to have himself put on earth, tortured and executed in atonement for the sins of humanity. What kind of a horrible, depraved notion is that?
You know, can I just say
Richard Dawkins. Well, in our discussion so far, we're left with the conundrum. How can you have an interventionist God in a world which is free and needs to be free? Bishop Anthony Fisher, let me start with you.
I think that we, if we believe that God is not just some God of the gaps that fills in the little bits we don't understand and we call that God, but is something much, much more important, much richer, and that is the reason that anything is, not just the reason the bits are that we don't understand, but the reason behind it all, then of course it's entirely within his scope. In view of our prayers or in hearing our prayers, to make those prayers and that moment part of the whole history, the whole cosmology, the whole plan as it unfolds. And that at those moments then we can experience his healing, his direction. That's not somehow him changing his mind or having had one plan and we've managed to bully him into a different plan by saying lots of prayers or by getting enough people together to say the same prayer.
This takes us back to an argument about omniscience, doesn't it? That is, God is all-knowing from the Alpha to the Omega, the beginning and the end. Therefore, whatever the situation is, there is a sense in which God is in it already.
Yes, and we call that providence, that sense that God is there carrying us, that he's there with us, that he's also there able to do something with us and for us. He's not just impotent in the face of our sufferings.
It can appear a contradiction, David Milliken.
Yeah, look, see, I believe both. I actually believe that God does step into the world. Otherwise, why am I going to pray? Why will I call on my people to pray in circumstances? Unless there is behind that fundamental sense of confidence that God is active in the world.
Heather, help us with this.
Yeah.
I actually see it as a revelation of the source of our life. And that's what, you know, the living water and those sorts of things that were talked about. If you drink from this, you have nowhere else you need to go. And when we live out of that source of life, we do not need to act violently, because acting violently is living out of fear and anxiety and hatred and all those other things. And so out of that, you can say that the revelation of God to us is not just about power or love in some abstract sense, but knowing that when we live our lives out of God in that humble acceptance of the invitation to be in communion with God, then we are different people and we are on a different path, and that the early Christians are called people of the way. So it's actually a different way of being.
Yes, that is, God is revealed through the way we live our lives, through us, through the encounter.
I'm not saying this.
David.
No, I don't think that's what Heather's saying.
No.
Heather, aren't you saying that Jesus presents, in a sense, the supreme confrontational example of love acted out?
Yes.
And that is such a confronting sort of example that if you look into the face of that act of Jesus, it's going to transform you.
Mm. Yes. That's right. I mean, when you say,
that's
John...
But John,
when you say that God is known through us, that's subsequent to us living our lives out of the Christian, you know, the Christian commitment to God. You know, God can be known through the way human beings act, but that's not primarily That's not something in and of itself without Jesus.
It doesn't. Does it resolve the essential conundrum that we're dealing with, though?
No, it doesn't. I don't think.
In terms of theodicy?
Yes.
It certainly goes some way to it, because you don't start with the wrong God.
Anthony Fisher?
I do think we still have to allow for the miraculous here, and I think David was saying that, that why would Christians pray if they didn't think it made some difference? Now, part of why they pray, of course, is makes a difference in them, but we also think that God's going to do something.
Yeah, God is changed by our prayers. Do you believe that?
Well, I'd say that everything that is changed by our prayers.
Is that a yes or a no?
Well, I'm not convinced I can change God, actually. I think he's a different kind of thing to the things I know that change or don't change, actually. He's not a thing, in fact, at all. But what God is includes someone that can intervene and can disrupt the ordinary patterns, and sometimes that's happened. And the most dramatic example in all of history of that, I think, is the incarnation, that the God, this the all powerful, the all knowing, could become a baby and a dying man. That's an extraordinary intervention, quite different to the ordinary course of nature, or to what we could ever expect or even hope for, plan for, to happen. But very often the way we encounter God is not in those miraculous, disruptive, surprising, astonishing things, but in the ordinary, the awesome, the beautiful, the challenging in nature, in ourselves, in each other. We meet God very often, I think, especially in people that we call holy. And the reason we use that word is we encounter something of God in them, we think. Something more than just the ordinary human being is at work there. And also in the Word of God, in the people of God, in different places of as it were, our daily, ordinary, godly life, we meet God. But there are miraculous times too. There are quite unexpected, unplanned moments of what we'd call grace, where it's not something we've brought about or could have predicted or could have deserved.
You're on Good Friday Night on ABC Radio around Australia. We're discussing the central image of Good Friday, the crucified Christ. How could a good God use evil means to bring about his redemptive message? What sort of God is this, says Richard Dawkins. Let's have another piece of music that reflects the depth and power of that imagery. Were you there when they crucified my Lord?
Were you there when they crucified my Lord? Were you there when they crucified my Lord?
Were you there when they crucified my Lord? You're on Good Friday Night on ABC Radio around Australia. Our guest, Heather Thompson, Senior Lecturer in Theology at St Mark's Theological College in Canberra, Reverend Dr. David Milliken of the Uniting Church, and the recently installed Catholic Bishop of Parramatta, Bishop Anthony Fisher, also with a doctorate. Thank you all for joining us. Now, we're in the midst of, we've talked about the sort of nature of God as an intervening God. Let me bring up a couple of the old classical conundrums about the problem of evil, that is, how can you have a good God with so much evil rampant in the world? Some people say, well, look, you've got to weigh it in the balance. This might be a veil of tears, but things are judged in the afterlife, and that we don't understand things now, but it'll all be made clear in the economy of God, that God has a way of sorting things, these things out. And I think there's a famous anecdote of Bertrand Russell in his Why I'm Not a Christian, who said that's a very strange argument, because if I take a crate of oranges and the bad oranges are on the top, I don't assume that there'll be good oranges underneath. I assume from my example of the bad oranges on top that probably the whole crate's rotten. I'm probably exaggerating what Bertrand Russell said, but that was the general tone of his argument. Heather, this is one of the classic arguments about evil, that somehow the afterlife will justify it. You see no power in this argument?
No, not much, no. I don't really go with those who, especially if they're atheists, who solve the whole thing by blaming God. I mean, why don't they look at people and get upset? Because people are still...
because God, but God's the architect of the universe, you see.
Right. But what's difficult is reading the paper in the mornings and seeing, you know, trying to maintain that it is a good world. I mean, there are things there that are really upsetting, and I can't help believing that it is a fallen world. And one of the things that the Christian faith does is hold that belief, whereas humanism and atheists and others don't actually believe in a fallen world. So I don't know quite how they understand or you know, come to terms with the most evil side of human beings. But when I see that, then I look to God for redemption, for another way, for a force of or power of good in the world. And in a sense, we have to all choose which side to side on as well. So I don't know how they choose that.
Anthony Fisher.
I think that when we meet terrible suffering, when we meet the baby that is innocent baby that's dying, or the tsunamis or the earthquakes and the things,
and there's no human agency involved.
Yeah, there's no one to blame, that's as right. It were.
Yeah.
Then there is one instinct is to blame God, either the one God, and you're just angry with him, and many human beings experience that at different times. And in some ways, it's that's a tribute to their faith, and I don't want to belittle that, because they still love the one they're angry with, and eventually they often get over the anger, and there's a deeper wisdom that
And in a crude level, sometimes it's explained by, oh, well, in the economy of God, all things will be sorted out, which doesn't seem a very satisfactory answer.
I think there's some wisdom in that, and that is, there is wisdom in the thought that this life that we have isn't all that there is, and that in fact it might just be the entree to the main course, and that the whole thing won't make sense till we've seen it all, and that there might be something better coming. That's a thing to hope for, and I think a thing that many of the poor and dispossessed and hurt through history have hoped for, and reasonably hoped for, because they knew that they're in the hands of a loving God that could bring great things even after this life for them. But it's not enough, because it can be an excuse for doing nothing about the situation now. We just either do anything about it ourselves, or others with power doing anything about it, because they can say, oh, well, you'll get your reward in the end, you'll be vindicated in the end, so we'll just let the evils continue. And I think also it's only part of our wisdom about suffering and about what we might say to suffering, to say, well, you can hope for better beyond this. Yes, I think we should hope for better beyond this, and we should do what we can about it right now as well for making it better. But there's other things to say about what suffering does in us and around us too, what it might make of us, approached well, what it might make of those around us if they cooperate in approaching it well. And that, there we talk about the redemptive power that suffering can have, the way it can affect a person's character and story and that of the community of people around them. And that's in this life, not just in the life beyond.
Yes, there's some sort of therapeutic agency in suffering. I mean, it seems pretty crude to state it as baldly as that, and people do. There's no doubt that people do learn through their experiences of life. But are those appeals to the transcended benefit any real explanation, David, for you?
Look, I think this is the only question. I think it is the question that every religion should be addressing, is the persistence of violence within human history. At the end of the 20th century, we're faced with this terrible paradox. At one hand, you can say human beings have demonstrated this astonishing capacity for creativity and so on. But on the other hand, it's 100 years of the worst barbarity in human history. So what the hell do we do about that? Do we just simply go into this next century now and say, oh, well, let's hope it's better? So it is the question. Why is there a persistence of evil in human history? And I have New Age friends who sort of say, oh, well, it's part of a progressive evolution that we're actually getting better. You know, we're moving into a new era of brotherhood and so forth. You know, well, I don't see any evidence of that at all. Some people say that they try and sort of talk evil out of existence and say, well, look, it's not real, like the Christian scientists of the past, who would say, well, in fact, if you ascribe evil at some sort of existence, then you actually make evil evil. If you deny it in some sort of magical way, then you can live as if it doesn't exist. Well, that doesn't happen. I mean, Christian scientists get sick and angry and like the rest of us. Or you could say, well, reincarnation certainly gets God off the hook, because now you can say, well, there's a massive cosmic order, and that somehow, as you're saying, evil will be sorted out, karma will deal with, and that some sort of superb balance will gradually emerge. Well, that robs you of moral outrage, and it just sets you on a path of sort of relativism now. I think that the Christian understanding of the nature of evil is one of the most important contributions we have to the national and contemporary debate about human beings, because Christians, of all religions, is the most earthy, and it's the one that actually confronts evil, looks it in the face, and says, and calls it for what it is, and holds us responsible, the most unpalatable of all explanations, you know. But that's what it is. So, and that the story in Genesis is really interesting in the sense that it holds us responsible. The choice is given to us, and we make a catastrophic mistake, which we now bear the consequences of. Now, it's interesting, if you look at the Islamic accounts of the Garden of Eden, they are slightly different. And Satan is given a higher role. Satan actually, in a sense, overwhelms the choice of human beings. So you've got these two different understandings now, and that will affect the way you look at the whole of life. I think Christians create a culture of guilt, and Islam creates a culture of blame. Now look at how differently that will affect the way we think of education, of law, of absolutely everything. So this question, in all its subtleties, is extremely crucial, I think.
Heather, do you want to sort of inject an observation into David's worldview there?
No, I think I'd go along with that. But I was thinking as he was talking that we've been assuming that suffering leads people to possibly atheism, whereas suffering also leads people to faith and to a search for God. And one story that comes to my mind is a friend of mine who thinks back to her childhood, and she was abused by her father for years when she was young. And she then, in that situation, thought to herself, what's happening to me is wrong. There must be some good behind this. And she spent her life searching for it. And so there are ways in which suffering can actually lead people into a search for faith and a relationship with God, and I don't want us to lose sight of that.
There's an element there that goes back to David's point about moral outrage. If you take that view, if you take the view that ultimately you can think through these sufferings and you get some therapeutic value out of it, that takes you to a position where ultimately, if you follow it through rigorously, all evil can ultimately be explained as working towards ultimate good, and that deprives you of moral outrage because everything's for good then. Everything's for the best.
That's right.
But I never said that.
No. Well, tease out for me.
I mean, some things that people suffer, you can't help but suffer. You know, if you're going to get old and die, as we all will, what's the use of being morally outraged at that? Well, you know, it's better to get a different view. Whereas there is some suffering at which we need to be morally outraged and try to change it for the present and for the future generations. You know, in injustice and a system of government in which people are suffering, a totalitarian government. So you have to discern suffering as well, I think. And I certainly hold to moral outrage, and I see the resurrection as a form of God's response to suffering. Like the suffering that Jesus went through, the resurrection is his answer to that, that I side with the one who suffered and died. I do not side with the one who do the killing.
You're on Good Friday Night on ABC Radio. We're almost out of time in this discussion about evil, the nature of, and where it takes us. And Heather, your last point there has taken us back to, I guess, where we began. That is, the power ultimately has proved to be so long-lasting, certainly in the Christian tradition, not so much for the way one resolves the philosophical and intellectual arguments, but for the power of the imagery and the identity that's involved. That here we have images which are so resonant and so powerful that they do strike to the heart of each of us and in some ways can carry us through. That at the interesting thing about Christianity is that it starts at the darkest point.
It's a very strange aesthetic that we've got, isn't it? That we can look at a man being tortured to death and see it as a thing of great beauty. And it's almost, you know, I almost hate saying that because it's almost as if I'm trivialising something, but it is true. And if we look at that, if we approach that with some reverence, deep inside the suffering of that man on the cross is a mystery of such transcendent and fundamental hope. And that's what we look for, really, is that. And that's why, you know, those sort of pompous outbursts of Dawkins, which are just derisory and insulting. I mean, he ought to know more about what we believe than use those easy parodies, you know.
Heather, your final word?
The word grace comes to mind, and we were actually talking about this in our class, thinking of examples of people who have said, you know, they've dealt with dying people or people who are suffering greatly, that there's a privilege in doing that. And we named it as an experience of grace because it's a giving where you don't expect to receive anything. And I think when we look at the cross, we see the grace of God who gave God's all for us without expecting anything in return. And that's part of what David names as the beauty of meditating on the cross, I think. It shakes you, it undoes you a bit. It invites you into a communion with that God who does that for us.
Bishop Anthony Fisher.
I think that lots of times in our life, believing and hoping and loving is fairly easy because the situation we're in, the person we're with, it comes very naturally. It's supported in all sorts of ways, but there are other times when, as this show has shown, it's really challenged, and particularly it's challenged, I think, by suffering and innocent suffering above all, and that we can still love and still hope and still believe in each other, in the world, in God, in ourselves. That is told on Good Friday. And with the man that loved to the end, totally gave himself completely to us, and that that man was God, the reason that everything is, and that that can save us. And I think that's a wonderful bit of good news amidst the suffering that's told on that cross today.
At its weakest point can emerge its strongest truth.
Yes.
Mm. It's called the mystery, really, isn't it? This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. You can download your favourite Sunday night interviews from our website at abc.net.au/Sunday Nights with an S. Thank you for listening.